One of my core identities in life is to be a worshiper, because I find whenever I worship, I realize who I truly am, that I'm a child of God. But growing up in church, I'm sure my worship experience was pretty much the same as most of yours. We had a hymn book, and it was the same hymn book for all the Presbyterian churches in Ireland, so the repertoire was all the same. We were a small country church, so we were late and last to change. We heard of the towns getting this book called Mission Praise, where choruses were being sung, and eventually the choruses came in to our congregation. But when I was a young adult, there was a songwriter from Belfast called Robin Mark, and he was creating a new wave of songs that did something to us. Songs like Lion of Judah, Men of Faith, Rise Up and Sing, Shout to the North and the South. And if you lived in Ireland, that had huge significance, that Christ would be Lord of all these divisions. And these songs had a rhythm, a Celtic rhythm that just went deep into our bones, dislodging Presbyterian guilt in the bones. It just went so deep. We'd never sung songs like that before. It was always British hymns. And it was roughly this time that I was beginning to sense the call to Kenya, and I'd made some trips over to Nairobi. And to my surprise, what was happening there was very similar to our story back at home. They too were singing British hymns, but every so often they would sing a song in their own language, and they would almost leap into life. They would come alive. And I thought, huh, that's very like what we're experiencing back at home in Ireland. They were being set free. But you know what? I needed the people in Kenya to show me what I couldn't see in myself, that I had grown up in this post-colonial identity, this post-colonial setting where there was this dualism. We had our British identity, where we were more British than the British, but there was this yearning to be free, to be set free. And when you grow up with these kind of tensions of who you really are, the struggle is, how do you find your voice? How do you find your voice in worship, where you circle round the throne room of the Lamb, and you join with all the other nations? How do you find your place? And as we worship in COS today, the question I have is, how do we enable this church family to be a place where people can bring their whole selves into worship, not just a part, but their fullest expression, so that the dominant culture is not dampening out the minority voice? How do we enable this family to worship in a way that we're not just turning up to worship out of boring duty, but we're coming alive? How do we do that? Where we're on the edge of our seats, where we're ready to leap into action and be doers of the word, not just hearers only. Where through our worship, we're changed and we're clarified, and we see a bigger picture of the kingdom and what we're called to do. Well, Acts chapter 6 might just help us as we reinvestigate what this story is about. We need to learn to delegate, not discriminate. This is a neat little case study in Jerusalem of how this parochial worship was about to break out of its Jerusalem structures to have global influence. And all through, we see this problem that begins to surface in Acts 6. We see how the disciples respond to the problem, and then we see the result of how they dealt with it. But because we've reached this place in Acts where the Holy Wind is coursing through the veins of the disciples and it's blowing through all these settled habits, where the disciples are coming together and sharing absolutely everything to those who have need. They're living generous lives in common fellowship together. And the Great Commission has started in this place in Jerusalem. But how is it going to break out? How is it going to break out of the ethnic bounds and the parish bounds? And alongside this movement, you have outside pressures and you've inside pressures. We saw the outside pressures last time, where the religious authorities were trying to suppress this movement and saying to Peter and John, don't speak out. Get in line with what the religious authorities should be saying. So the pressure was coming from the outside, but there was also inside pressures in this movement. You had people like Ananias and Sapphira who didn't want to share all their possessions. There were people who were challenging the system. But when we reach Acts chapter 6, there's a very different challenge laid at the door of the disciples. And it's different because it's calling the disciples back to first principles, to look after the widows in their midst. This is a justice cry right from the heart of God himself, to look after the widows. And the Grecian Jews were complaining that they were being overlooked. The Hebrew Jews and their widows were getting plenty at the table, but the Grecian Jews and their widows were feeling left out. So what's going on here? What's at the heart of this problem? Well, it depends who you read. I think it's so interesting that the biblical scholars say, well, this is just a problem of administration, that the church is expanding, this place is growing, but the administration has not caught up with it. It's simply a problem of structure. But the missiologists say, no, it's about culture. It's about power. On the one hand, you can say, yes, the church is growing and the administration is weak. But on the other hand, you need to understand who these Hellenists and who these Hebraic Jews were. You see, on the one hand, the Hebrew Jews, they were the originals. They spoke Aramaic. They understood what was being said in worship. They knew all the ceremonial laws about how to gather around the table. Some maybe even had known Jesus personally. But then you have these Hellenist Jews, the diaspora, the people who had lived in exile. Maybe they were getting old and retired and they wanted to come back to Jerusalem as their final resting place. But the thing was, they weren't pure the way the Hebrew Jews were. They didn't speak Aramaic fluently. They had Greek as their language. And when they came back to Jerusalem, they would have operated in cultural silos. They would have set up their own little separate synagogues. They didn't have the pure table fellowship of the insiders. And you can see how already this would have made them feel on the outside, how they would have felt inferior. I can't be the one to speak up in church because I'm not a founding member. It doesn't belong to me. I'm not part of this dominant culture. And so the problem doesn't manifest explicitly, but it manifests implicitly through muttering. And that word in verse 1, this muttering, is so interesting because it's the word that was used of the children of Israel in the desert when they were muttering at God's goodness. Take us back to Egypt because it was better in the good old days when we were slaves. We can't handle this manna every day. It's boring. This muttering. It's what happens when you forget God's goodness and you feel you're entitled to better. That's the muttering. It's when you begin to chip away at others and nibble at other people's egos because of your wounded spirit. And your world begins to get small rather than big. That's the muttering that happens. We know that place, don't we? Every week we get smaller and smaller. But look at how the disciples pick up on this and react. I love that the first thing they do is simply listen. They're able to listen to the minority group without dismissing them. They've created such a safe place in worship that people are bringing themselves in, and they know they'll be taken seriously. In a world where we read people bringing their full selves to Facebook rather than to our faces, we need to be reminded of how we can create a safe place for people to be listened to rather than this structural schizophrenia culture of the network. And that's why an important part of worship and what we do on a Sunday is to have food and coffee after church where we can listen to other voices, to get out of our cultural silos, to listen to the minority. They listen. But look at what they don't do. They don't set up a separate synagogue for these Hellenists to set up a system of care. Neither do they blame and say it's your fault. Neither do they go all defensive. Nor do they do what white Westerners often default in doing. They don't swoop in and try and save them. Instead, they say, maybe we're part of the problem too. They take ownership in their leadership for trying to do too much. And they need to create this space for others now to step in and serve, rather than spread their leadership out too thinly, and so they delegate rather than discriminate. And even though this discrimination was probably not intentional, it doesn't say that, it was discrimination nonetheless. And so all these disciples are gathered together and they're asked to democratically select 7 administrators. And there was one quality that these administrators had to have. They had to have a sense of fullness in their being. I love how many times that word fullness crops up in this story. Verse 5, choose people full of faith, full of wisdom. And then you have Stephen, who was chosen, a man full of the Holy Spirit. Because these are the people who see fullness in life, who can see life even when faced with death. These are people who can see hope even in the face of despair. These are the people who, when everyone else sees the end of an administration, the end of an era, these are the people who are going to see the beginning. These are the people of the resurrection who walk by faith and not by sight. And these were the people who were going to push this mission out of the Jerusalem walls into the world. Now, do you see what's at stake here? If the disciples had just kept on doing what they were doing, they would have got burnt out. And the gospel would never have leaped over those walls of Jerusalem and spread, and discrimination would have continued. I wonder, does that speak to you this morning? Are you ever that one person who tries to do the work of 10 instead of being the one person to empower the other 10 to do the work? Maybe we need to train our eyes again to look for the fullness of God in others and think of how that will change our structures. And what was the result? Well, the church was unified, the church multiplied, and God was magnified. Even, it says, a large number of priests began to follow Jesus. Wow. Now, in the New Testament, there's two words for crown in the Greek. There's diadema, which talks about the royal crown. You can only put that crown on your head if you have the royal birthright. But there's another word for crown that I love. It's called Stephanos. And that's where you get the word Stephen from. That's the victor's crown that you receive for being faithful. Revelation 2 says, "Be faithful unto death, and I will give you the crown of life." And that's the image of Stephen in Acts chapter 6. Someone who was so saturated with God, he was faithful unto death. So what will it take for COS to be released into an even greater ministry in this place? What will it take to create enough space where the voices that are vulnerable are heard instead of the most influential? Maybe we as leaders need to recognize where we have failed, where we try to do too much out of quiet desperation rather than being spirit-filled. Isn't it so fitting that one of the pivotal texts in Acts which breaks the kingdom out of Jerusalem is through the life of someone like Stephen, who simply lived the fullness of God. He was saturated with God's presence, and he faithfully poured himself out for others. That's what it takes. The letting go. The letting go of chipping away of, and instead creating pathways for leaders of the marginalized groups, of catching the vision of Jesus who looked after the woman who were there at the cradle and the woman who were there at the cross, and keeping our eyes on this bigger vision of Jesus and letting that mission flood our being so that this new wine breaks the old wineskins. There was once a musician in London who'd reached a place where he knew he'd failed as a musician. His style of music was falling out of fashion in the English elite. And during this time, a wealthy nobleman put in this musician's hand a word book of selected Bible verses. At the same time in Ireland in the 1730s, there'd been year after year of poor harvests, and things were pretty bad. In England, there was protection for the poor through the poor laws, and it meant that those who were in need simply had to come under the parish bounds, and the church would administer care. But in Ireland, there was no such laws for the poor, and so the minority culture was suffering. The agricultural economy had totally collapsed, and so the destitute were traveling into the city of Dublin to try and get help, relying on goodwill and charity. And many of the private hospitals in the city were noticing this pattern and were saying, "We need to do better for our poor. We need to do more." And so they asked if they could set up some musical concerts, subscription concerts, to raise funds for those who had no voice. And when this musician in London got an invitation to come over to Dublin, in a remarkably short period of time, he took that word book of Bible verses and he began to write something. But getting this music performed was fraught with difficulties because we can't perform this kind of music in a cathedral. It's more like opera. It's more like a show. And so he had to take it out of the building into a music hall in Fishamble Street. That's where all the fishmongers sold their daily catch. And so in Fishamble Street, this performance happened. And it was so successful, more and more subscription concerts were lined up in order to help the poor, in order to give the minority a voice in Dublin again. And this sacred text was redeeming the city. It was redeeming the voice of the poor. It was redeeming that artist. And not only that, But this was the place where the Messiah was born. Handel's Messiah was born. Had the Messiah stayed within the cathedral walls, it would have not had nearly the same impact. But resurrection was at work, and the poor were redeemed, and Handel's career was turned around. And my challenge to you, as people who carry the presence of God into your workplaces, into your families, into your lives, too often we operate from a place of scarcity rather than abundance. How can we recalibrate our lives so that we're not living on this edge of burnout? What do we do? Well, we do what the disciples did and say, prayer is important to us. Let's carve out this space of prayer again. Because when you pray, you begin to see this world through your spiritual eyes. The root word for contemplative prayer is about clearing out the space in front of the altar so that the divine presence can fill it. You know, too often our vision for mission has been guided by this idealized vision of the promised land where the tribes came in, they clear the land of cultural idols, but then you put your own in and you begin to carve up the land and dissect it. What tribe gets what portion of land? A bit like dissecting a butterfly. You take the life out of it. Shame on us. Shame on us when we carve up mission in that way. That's not the vision of Pentecost. The vision of Pentecost is to be like the Levites who went into the land and say, this doesn't belong to us, but God will be our inheritance. And from that place, God gave them cities. And in those cities, there was places of refuge where the people who had blood on their hands could come and find safety again. And when we come to worship, this is what we're called to do. We're coming to gather around the table that has bought us freedom. We're coming to a place where Jesus' blood has bought us freedom. And this is the place of transformation, where we're saying there's room in this circle for everybody. No matter what culture you're from, you're the one who can carry God's presence wherever you go. A couple of months ago, I was telling the story to some seminary students about Celtic worship and about how Robin Mark just burned in my bones, shout to the north and the south, sing to the east and the west, Jesus is Lord of all, and how that was our prayer for revival. And one Korean student said to me, you know, while you were singing that in Ireland, we were singing that song too in Korea. Because we want North and South to be healed as well. And when you catch that vision of what it means to be an authentic believer, it will have legs of its own. It will travel. So come back to prayer. Come back to the table. Come back to that authentic calling of the fullness of God in your lives. And see what God will do through you. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen.